Welcome back to the Privacy Impact Shop, where I'm joined by my good friend and colleague, Sharb.
Hi.
And our guest speaker again, Mr. Frank Jones.
Hi, everybody.
So we've got a couple of topics we want to talk about. We want to talk about what's not working in privacy and what we're seeing out there, what organisations are talking about, what they're coming to us with, and generally just a general feel of, you know, what's not working and what could be better around the privacy space. So should we dive into that?
Sure. Frank, do you want to start as you are guest?
Yeah, so I'm Frank Jennings from HCR Law. I've been doing tech law for 25 years, and everything that I do has a data protection element to it. So what's not working in data privacy? Well, depends upon how seriously the data controller takes it. And I talk a lot about data hygiene, is the making sure that the data set is clean. It's accurate, it's up to date, it's only been kept for as long as necessary, and then it's deleted afterwards. And I don't think we should underestimate how difficult that can be. If you're constantly interacting with the data subject and making sure that your data set is up to date, then that's fine, isn't it? But if you've got some data lying around for, and I see this a lot, you've had data lying around for a year, 2 years, 5 years, 20 years, if you've not had meaningful interactions with that individual, you should probably start thinking about cleaning it.
Yeah, we the common theme, certainly from a cyber and infosec perspective, is that when we're drafted in to support companies with incident response and incident management, this is often, yes, certainly if personal data is at stake or included, this is often comes up as a common vector when we start to talk about notification, and if that's something that needs to be done, we need to notify customers and conduct things like password resets and provide advice and guidance and that kind of thing. That's when you usually, or organizations usually, get to a point where they go, oh, hold on a minute, you know, let's now look at the data. And then I think the penny drops as to, yes, we're storing data, you know, we've gone through this policy of if in doubt, keep it.
Sure.
And you start to go, well, are we going to notify customers that we've reset their password and we haven't had any interaction from, you know, with them for 10 years or maybe even longer? So I think at that point, that's a quite specific example of where I think the penny starts to drop with organisations, as actually this is a bit of a problem. Why are we storing all of this data? And now it's giving us, you know, quite a big headache at a point where we're already, you know, trying to deal with a delicate and potentially negative situation.
Yeah. I think as well, another area of where this issue is highlighted is when you get a subject access request. And, you know, this varies from client to client, depends what sector they're in, you know, what type of data they hold. Some tend to get them quite regularly because of the nature of what they do, others less so. But it always, you know, when we're pulled into this, and I don't know if you've got the same situation, Frank, when like someone goes, oh, we got a subject access request. What do we do? What do we have to give them? And, you know, you try and be as pragmatic as you can and sort of say, well, you know, but ultimately it's pretty much, you know, if it relates to the individual directly or indirectly, it's probably, you know, got to be, you know, a copy of that data's got to go across. And
so
that's
all the exemptions.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
That's part of my job, is when I handle data subject access requests. It's whether or not the data set is clean and up to date and accurate and whatever, it's can we apply any exemptions to them? But yeah, I mean, if you're getting data subject access requests on a regular basis, then you're probably going to be well versed in what you should be doing, and you should use that as an excuse to clean up your data set.
You should, but it comes down to a bit of economics. And the economics is this: how much does it cost to go through a data discovery piece, find out where data is, shadow IT, then determine what you need and what you don't. And every department will go, we need that, we need that. So you've got that whole political thing going on, to the cost of dealing with a subject access request. Do do you kind of know what a subject access request? I mean, when I've asked clients, they say a subject access request, and there's quite a wide range here. It can be anything from around 700 to 2,000 per request. When you take into account lost time of people, especially if it's a manual process, lost time.
Do you mean hours or pounds?
Pounds. So 2,000 pounds, up to 2,000 per request. Yeah. Because, you know, you've got to take, you know, possibly people off from IT, other departments, functional areas, to start finding data. Then there's that whole sifting through the data, yeah, which is often a manual process. You know, because you want to redact some information, and there might be legitimacy for that, or there might not. And then, you know, this is even before we start, and we're seeing more of this, where you've got video content as well. So customers are now starting to think about, okay, what about pixelation software and things like that? So all of these are bringing in costs, and I think there's a tipping point where you sort of go, how much is it going to come to actually deal with the issue of cleaning the data up, which includes finding out where it is, and then actually dealing with a subject access request? You mentioned exemptions. What sort of exemptions might you sort of want to apply?
First of all, if the data set is clean, then you're going to avoid the costs of having to store that data in the first place, aren't you? So, yeah, there's a cost of dealing with the subject access request and the data discovery element that goes with that. But if you don't have the data because you've cleaned it, not only do you not have to disclose it, provided your retention policy was accurate, but you're not paying for data for however long anyway.
Yep.
Some of the exemptions then would be in relation to third-party data. So if I want to get access about information that you hold about me, Sharb, that doesn't automatically include anything that you've said to Ben or Ben said to you about me.
Okay.
So there's a potential exemption there. There's going to be a potential anything that we've spoken about, for example, as legal advice,
privilege,
professional privilege. If I can even say that, it's easy for you to say.
No, it isn't. That's why I'll let you struggle, because I can't say it.
If I've given you some legal advice and Ben wants to get access to data held about him, well, that's possibly going to be protected by a privilege, so he's not going to get access to that. There's going to be data management information. Management information in data held about a business, and there might be some negotiations that you're going to have with a data subject, so as part of an exit, for example. So there are a number of different exemptions which you would need to evaluate, not just chuck all the data straight out. You need to make sure that you're giving the right data, because if you're giving too much data or the wrong type of data, or not exercising your exemptions properly, then you could cost the business anyway.
Yeah, 100%. I'm interested on one of the exemptions and the guidance that's come out around. It is not, so the guidance that we're seeing from the European Data Protection Board, I believe, is that it is not the controller's function to determine why the request is being made.
No, and man, I get to see this a lot as a from a legal perspective, of course, that. This is run in tandem with litigation. So litigation will have its own discovery element. So as part of a litigation process, we get access to certain data, and that follows the normal process. What happens is in tandem with that, an individual will make a subject access request to say, well, I want that data. And we know that that's only being made as a in conjunction with the litigation which is over here, whether that's whatever it happens to be, an employment claim or otherwise.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're right, the ICO doesn't really care. And I tell clients that, yeah, we know it's happening because of the litigation, but the ICO doesn't care. You have to take it on its own merits, which is that the data subject wants access to their data.
And it could be to check the correctness of it, the lawfulness, the completeness, but
what they're looking for is a smoking gun to help
absolutely
with the litigation.
But that's not can't ask that, can we?
That's not relevant.
So
why do you want your data? Is it because to find a smoking? No, that's irrelevant.
So if that's for guidance and that's the position, where does that overlay with? Because I'll be honest with you, I'm a little bit, depends on the client, depends on, you know, what the situation is. Where does that sit with manifestly unfounded request? Yeah, so that's exactly what I generally do.
Yeah. Manifestly unfounded or excessive is it's one of those niche categories that if you've got somebody who's deliberately being difficult, it's like the vexatious litigant in the courts, isn't it? It's somebody who's truly is a proven to be a real pain. I don't come across that very often. I mean, if you've got a data set which is absolutely huge, then data subject access request might be excessive in the sense that you've got lots and lots of data about that person. But then guess what I'm going to say? Have better data hygiene practices. That maybe you don't need to keep all that data, in which case your subject access request would be more manageable.
So if I came to you, basically the answer I'm going to get is, I told you so, you should have cleaned it up.
You should have come to me.
Okay, but I am, so I get the excessive part. Yeah, if somebody's making a subject access request every other week, I would feel confident to say we can refuse that. It's the first part of this. It's the manifestation. How do you say if it's unfounded or not with the guidance that says it's not the controller's, they can't ask why you're making the request?
Yeah, that's a good question. Ultimately, the controller needs to establish, do you have data about that subject? Well, first of all, is this subject the person who they say they are? Is it actually Sharb?
Yeah.
Or is it just Ben pretending to be Sharb?
Not again, but okay.
Again, we've talked about that.
Yeah.
But then on the basis that I know it is you and you're making a subject access request to me, it's a fairly simple process. Do I have data about you? And it's the point at which we start to identify, I've got loads, or no, I don't have anything. And that's the point at which we start asking questions. Is this unfounded? Is this excessive?
Yeah.
But I've got data about you, so...
I get the excessive bit, but the unfounded, I can't get it. I can't see.
What's your reason for doing it? But
you're not allowed to ask.
It doesn't really matter, does it?
No, and the guidance is, it is not
the
controllers.
I either have data about you or I don't.
Yeah.
So how's it going to be unfounded? Just because you don't like me anymore?
Yes. So I don't know how you like apply that. No, it's okay.
Well, now we're getting to I'm
just processing that. I'm just processing that. It's okay. We might need to go off camera or so have a little cry, but it's okay. But yeah, it's... I just don't know how you can square that. Where it says, you have a right to sort of say, oh, because it's, unfounded, but you can't then say... I can't consider why the request is being made.
Yeah.
It just almost seems like, how does that work?
No, good point.
So moving on, I guess this leads us quite nicely into, perhaps how challenges and success stories of building good, positive privacy cultures within business. And I think part of this stems from, well, let's just keep, everything forever. Data wise, and that might be coming from commercial reasons, which not when you dig into that, it's not always the case, but it might be just poor and lack of good culture around data protection and data privacy. So what are we seeing out there within our customers and generally within the market around challenges and success stories with building good privacy culture within businesses?
I think let's look at what a negative impact that drives good behaviour. So if there's been a data breach, that generally drives good behaviour after the breach, or it drives a change, an approach, because suddenly it's moved up the agenda.
Yeah, depending upon the outcome of that breach.
But sure.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, a typical lawyer would always say it depends.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you take it seriously and there is some real world impact as a result of having been breached, and maybe there's an investigation with the ICO, now you're worried that either the ICO is going to do more than just rap you on the knuckles and actually issue a fine, then yes, you're definitely going to take it more seriously as a result of that.
Well, with that said, I mean, we've been involved in plenty of cases, and I think some have been, obviously more severe than others. But, I can think of a few examples where, we've discussed and thought, well, this is definitely going to instigate change. And on some of them, it hasn't. So
I think you mentioned, you know, the action, and you're right in terms of that. You're absolutely right, because just because there's been a notification, just because it's been a breach, does not necessarily, you know, start that change, because it's what the regulator's going to do. And what, so, you know, and I don't want to necessarily sort of make any, I was going to say any enemies, but maybe I should say more enemies, about, you know, talking about the potency of certain regulators in terms of how they act. But if you look at, say, someone like CNIL, or, you know, some of the German regulators or the Polish regulator, I think if you were operating, they were your lead supervisory authority, and you had to notify them, you would probably be quite concerned that action was coming your way. Whereas maybe some of the other regulators, not so much.
I like to think the ICO is fairly pragmatic, and they've got, they will take enforcement action, and they will investigate. But ultimately, they're reasonably pragmatic. But that doesn't mean that just because they're pragmatic, you've got a free-for-all in the UK. Not at all. If you go back to basics, it's supposed to be privacy by design. You're supposed to bake privacy into everything. It's not just, and this is one of the challenges that businesses might face. We are how many years now in down the line into GDPR, 8 years or so.
Mm-hmm.
It's doesn't mean that we're all compliant now. It doesn't mean that we've still got best practice or privacy by design. So I think some of the challenges that businesses are going to face is making sure that they bake it into the data set from the start. It's how you collect it, how you process it, what you use it for, how long you keep it for. And it's not just the data protection manager or DPO's responsibility. It's the responsibility of everybody. And ultimately, as they'll find out once you have a breach, is the responsibility of the board. You can't just push this onto insurance and hope that will pay out.
I absolutely agree. You know, I'm not disagreeing with any of that. And we do have a sort of, you know, the European Data Protection Board, you know, there to try and get, you know, some sort of form of consistent approach on actions as well. So, you know, regardless of any, you know, statistical or actually perceived approach by regulators across, you know, the jurisdictions, we are starting to get some sort of consistency in their approach. No, if we look, you know, just the last one, where the DPC took action against LinkedIn, that was initiated by the French supervisory authority that contacted them and said, you know, we've been notified of this from an agent, from a, you know, charitable organisation. You're the lead SA in this, because they sit, you know, in your neck of the woods. Off you go. So, you know, action is, you know, being taken. But, you know, you're absolutely right. It's more than just enforcement action. And, you know, the idea of incorporating privacy by design and data protection by design, data protection by default, I tend to find there's a lack of understanding about what that actually means. Personally, I don't know what your sort of view of it is.
Well, it depends on the stage in the market that the business is. If they're coming into it as a startup, then they're too busy trying to make sure that the lights stay on and they don't get booted out of the premises. So compliance often follows down the line somewhere.
Yeah.
And then the more established businesses who are able to keep the lights on now and are able to pay rent, then they've got to start looking at some of these things. There's a decision making curve, isn't there? At some point, you're going to have to start paying attention to this and this. And this might not be data privacy today or data protection today. That might be something down the road, down the line on your roadmap.
Yeah, and that's a good way to approach it.
So not everybody takes data protection as seriously as GDPR requires them to yet.
Well, that, I guess, would be, you know, because, you know, without going too off piece, that's the thing about, you know, we have a comprehensive system. We've got one, you know, data protection regulation. If personal data, it's covered and fantastic. Maybe one of the downsides of that, and if you look at, say, a US sectorial model where they've got, you know, regulations, you know, depending on what sector you're in, you know, COPPA, GLBA, HIPAA, et cetera, et cetera, they can be more targeted and specific on what those requirements are in that sector. I'm not necessarily saying which one's right or wrong, but there are, you know, benefits to, you know, having a very targeted industry-specific regulation as opposed to something which is more broad. The downside is people don't all have the same level of protection, obviously.
So I think just drawing this back to the original point, I guess, and that's around, you know, implementing and ensuring positive culture, privacy culture within organisations. You know, regulation's one way to do it, but I think it's clear and obvious, and we probably all agree that just putting a regulation in place doesn't bring in a good culture. You know, I think it stems from the people, and you know, we see it within our customer base. You know, the organisations that tend to take it more seriously are because there are some real champions, there are some real leaders within that business that have either come into that business with experience of either perhaps being burnt before in some way, shape or form. Or they, you know, they have a real key interest within it and they bring that with them, and then they try and kind of filter that down and get the business, you know, their new business perhaps that they're working with to adopt that. But it absolutely stems with, you know, the people. And I think with the right people, you that's the absolute starting point of any sort of positive privacy culture.
100%. You need I think you hit the word, like, you know, the word is champion. I think the only other thing I would say about that is having a champion to first step, but that champion or whoever's going to lead it needs to understand the regulation. So they need some sort of, you know, certification or training or, you know, something there that will, and you know, it's one thing being passionate, but you need ability to go with that passion.
There's a little bit of carrot and stick, isn't it? The stick is the regulation, and the carrot is normally how can we make money by having a clean data set or privacy by design or looking after individuals or reducing money by not having massive data subject access when we don't have loads of data to respond to. So, and how can we get a march over our competitors by doing the using data in this particular manner?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So look, I think we're going to go for a bite to eat now. I think we've earned. And a bit of lunch.
At last.
So this has been the Privacy Impact Shop. Thank you very much to our guest, Frank. And thanks again, Sharb.
Pleasure.
Frank, where can our listeners and viewers hear more about you or see more about you?
Yeah, so I'm Frank Jennings. I'm on the HCR Law website. I'm also on my blog, theaiandcloudlawyer.com.
Thank you very much. And of course, you can subscribe and you can access our podcast on all the major platforms. And you can hear more or see more via our website, blackfootuk.com, and also our LinkedIn channels. Thank you very much. And we'll see you on the next one. Take care.
Cheers.
Thank you.